A group of Israeli settlers has stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the Akbar al-Quds. So this is ahead of a planned flag march that has drawn warnings from Palestinians. Fierce fighting is reported in eastern Ukraine, where Russian forces have intensified their attacks to capture more areas. Iran observes a day of national mourning for victims of the recent building collapse in the southern city of Abadan. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Our special coverage on Palestine, where the city of Al-Quds is on edge. Dozens of settlers protected by Israeli forces have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound ahead of a controversial flag march. Israeli forces deployed to the area have already attacked Palestinian worshippers. They've also made several arrests. Since early in the morning, the Israeli military has restricted Palestinians' access to the mosque. However, hundreds of worshippers have already gathered inside and outside the compound. Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other groups have warned the Israeli marchers against passing through the Al-Aqsa compound. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett says that the march will proceed along the planned route, despite warnings from Palestinian groups to keep the parade out of Muslim neighborhoods. Israelis hold the annual event to mark the occupation and annexation of the eastern part of Al-Quds in 1967. Last year, a similar rally led to an 11-day Israeli war on the Gaza Strip. Okay, now let's get some more information and some insight into this. So joining me will be Mona Kandil, our correspondent in Ramallah. Also with us will be Barry Grossman. He's an international lawyer and political analyst in Bali. Let's go to Ramallah to Mona, our correspondent there. Mona, at what stage are we? Looks like this has already started. Even before the march started, we have seen some tension there, right?
Well, that's right. Ahead of the controversial flag march that is supposed to take place almost after 3 to 4 hours from now, let's say, according to Israeli media, almost 2,000 Israeli settlers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex under the protection of Israeli police officers and Israeli security. This, of course, had angered the Palestinians. This, of course, had provoked the Palestinians, and tension rise. That's right. Palestinians who succeeded to remain in the Al-Aqsa Mosque and inside the area was the surrounded by the numerous gates of the old town of Al-Quds clashed with the Israeli settlers, throw stones. This is the only weapon they had inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. But the Israeli forces attacked the Palestinians there, fired heavy tear gas against them. A number of Palestinians had been wounded, and many had been arrested. We don't have the accurate number of those who were arrested by the Israeli forces, but the Israeli military themselves said that a number of Palestinians had been detained while they attacked the Israeli settlers to prevent them from raiding the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. For the Palestinians, of course, for the Muslims, these are not normal visits, or as they try to show the world that they ascended the area, the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, Al-Haram al-Sharif. They raided and stormed and desecrated the Muslim holy site. That's why Palestinians are angry, and Palestinians, of course, would do their utmost in order to protect the Muslim holy site and to force the Israeli settlers out of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Up till the moment, we are speaking about a number of protests had taken place also across the occupied West Bank, in Dehesh, in Beit Lahem. There was also fighting in Al-Arub refugee camp, as well as in Abu Dis near Al-Quds University, and also in Al-Khalil area, where Palestinians held the Palestinian flag, and toward these areas where are very close to the illegal settlements, in order to express their anger and rejection of the Israeli flag march, and as a message to the world that Al-Quds is a Palestinian Muslim holy city, and the Al-Aqsa must not be desecrated by the Jewish settlers.
Okay, now. Well, let me turn to Bali. Barry Grossman, why the Palestinians are sensitive about this Muslim neighborhood? They don't want the flag march to be conducted there.
Well, I mean, first of all, the Israeli claim on Jerusalem itself has no legal basis whatsoever. It never has done. It never will do. It doesn't matter which part of Israel you want, of Jerusalem you want to talk about. There was never any agreement, international agreement, that would have ceded control of Jerusalem to the occupation. So that's the starting point. Certainly by the time we get to East Jerusalem and Al-Quds, the argument becomes that much stronger, given that we're talking about a traditionally Muslim Palestinian area. And of course, Al-Quds itself and the Al-Aqsa Mosque is one of the most important holy sites in all of Islam. And moreover, Palestinian people and Muslims around the world. On the other side of the coin, occupation designs, and in particular, the plans of settlers to essentially take over the Temple Mount complex and erect what they consider to be a recreation of the Jewish temple that they argue used to stand there could not be clearer. The other thing that's very clear is that pretty much every year at around this time, starting with Ramadan and continuing afterwards, the occupation is using these provocations in order to trigger a response from Palestinians and then use that legitimate response in order to justify a full-on military offensive against Palestinians in the Gaza and to some extent in the West Bank. These marches, let's be clear about it, are very similar to the kind of orange marches that we saw the British put on in occupied Ireland. They serve no purpose except to provoke the people who have long lived there and consider those lands to be their ancestral lands. What it shows on the part of the occupation government is a complete lack of concern for security and resolving issues in order to move forward, and instead a complete commitment to provoking a response that can be used to trigger another military operation, so the occupation isn't already killing enough people. Okay. And to be clear about this, when it comes to access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the compound more generally, there's a committee in place. I believe it's actually technically based in Jordan, but it decides which non-Muslims may have access at various times to the mosque complex on application. It's not the occupation government. The occupation and has no legitimacy whatsoever in making these decisions.
All right, thanks for that. Let me thank my guests. We had Mona Candela, correspondent Ramallah, and Barry Grossman, international lawyer and political analyst in Bali. Thank you so much. Now, moving on, the Russian military is stepping up its campaign to take over the city of Severodonetsk in eastern Ukraine. According to local officials, the city is under heavy shelling. No estimates available of the scale of damage or casualties from today's fighting. On Saturday, they say at least two people died and 13 buildings were destroyed in the city. The Russian military says it's taking control of the nearby rail hub of Lyman and Donetsk, but according to Ukrainian officials, the city has not yet fallen. Moscow is pushing to seize the entire eastern regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, where it says it wants to protect the local pro-Russia population. It's also hitting areas farther away, including capital Kiev, with air raids. Now here's Jana Miller from Donetsk with an update on the situation on the ground there.
Well, Chechen fighters, who of course are fighting on behalf of Russia, have just posted on social media that they have taken the town of Donetsk, and they say, as they put it, they're cleaning up the city of any remaining Ukrainian soldiers. They said the rest of the Ukrainian soldiers have fled. But Severodonetsk is just one of many towns and villages that have been falling to the Russians over the last week as they step up this offensive in Donbass. I went to one of those towns in Severodonetsk a couple of days ago. In that town, despite being able to take damage, the Ukrainians just left the town, because in some towns or villages, the Ukrainians are just leaving, retreating, and they're trying to focus their defense in strategic areas. But it's difficult to see what Ukraine and indeed NATO are supplying Ukrainians with weapons. It's difficult to see if any game-changing heavy weapons are going to make their way to the Ukrainians in time for Russia to continue and take the whole of the Donbass. They have superiority, artillery superiority, and the Ukrainian troops on the ground just simply don't have weapons or capacity to withstand that kind of onslaught.
Russia says that the West is absolutely wrong in trying to link a global surge in food prices to the Ukraine war and Moscow's blockade of Ukrainian ports. The foreign ministry spokeswoman says the prices for agricultural products surged back in 2020 when the COVID pandemic caused major disruptions to supply chains. According to Maria Zakharova, the Western sanctions on Russia are, in her own words, the main catalyst for the existing negative trends. She also accused the U.S. and the EU of diverting some 20 million tons of Ukrainian grain meant for Africa and West Asia to warehouses in Europe. Zakharova also said that the U.S. is provoking a food crisis in Ukraine by depleting its grain reserves through a wheat-for-weapons scheme. Iran is calling on Turkey to respect Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity, and that after Ankara announced plans for a new military operation in the Arab country. Foreign Ministry spokesman says Tehran is opposed to any recourse to military action and the use of force to resolve disputes. According to Said Khatibzadeh, such measures violate the sovereignty and territorial integrity of countries and only complicate the situation. He said that Iran understands Turkey's security concerns, but the only way to address those concerns is through dialogue and respect for bilateral agreements with its neighbors. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has threatened to launch a new military operation in Syria to create what he calls a safe zone in the border area. Now, Iran's most senior military commander has visited a secret underground army drone base, and the general says that the sky is the limit when it comes to improving the country's drone capability.
The army is enhancing its drone power at a rapid speed. New drones capable of carrying out various missions are being manufactured in Iran. Coupled with the facilities of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, this has created two powerful drone arms for the country.
Major General Bagheri says that only samples of Iranian drone power are on display in the underground base, and they just represent a tip of the iceberg of the Iranian military prowess. He also noted that the Islamic Republic never underestimates threats and always remains vigilant. The top general got a first-hand account of the Iranian army's cutting-edge capabilities and the development of different types of military combat and long-range drones. Images released showed a Kaman 12 drone with a flight endurance of 12 hours. It's capable of carrying four domestically produced bombs and missiles. With a secret base becoming operational, Iran has turned into the top drone power in the region. Geopolitical analyst Hania Tarkian says Iran's considerable advances in drone capabilities highlight the fact that the world's balance of power is undergoing change.
First of all, we have to say that we are witnessing a change in the balance of power in the world. So the world system is going from unipolarity and the American hegemony towards multipolarity. And more countries are trying to reach or keep their independence. And this means that they have to keep military power, and they have to improve and to update their military power. And this is why Iran is showing his military capabilities. Of course, Iran has displayed only parts of its drone capability. There is much more. But this is very important because drones are going to be very significant in modern battles. We have seen this in Ukraine, in the battles in Ukraine. So Iran has to show that his military capabilities are improving, and this is because, as I said, the balance of power in the world is changing.
Iran is observing a day of national mourning for victims of a building collapse in the southern city of Abadan. The government has declared national mourning to condole with the three families. 7 days after the incident, emergency crews are still at the site clearing up the debris. Abadan's governor says another body was dragged from under rubble this morning, raising the number of confirmed deaths to 29. Rescue workers have also pulled dozens of people alive from the site. The unfinished Metropole building, located on Abadan's busiest street, crumbled last Monday, leaving dozens trapped in the ruins. Officials blame faulty construction practices for the incident. President Raisi has given assurances that whoever is responsible for the tragedy will be held accountable. And that's all for this bulletin from Tehran.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. A personality like Hamza is an unknown personality. We should teach ourselves and our people to think carefully on various matters and to make a correct decision. Had we but listened or used our intelligence, we should not now be among the companions of the blazing fire. They will then confess their sins. Chapter 67, verses 10 to 11. If we do not listen and think carefully, this is a sin. The Holy Quran says this clearly. According to the Commander of the Faithful, as quoted by Imam Baqir alayhi salam, peace and greetings be upon him, Hazrat Hamza was a manifestation of among the believers of men who have been true to their covenant with God. How does being true to their covenant with God take place? The full and complete form of it is to become a role model for divine teachings and divine commands and stepping forward for the path that God has specified. That is, such personalities become a manifestation of these qualities. We should learn this. God willing, if special people in society try to produce such personalities, each of them will be able to save society in sensitive times. This is really the case.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We should not be satisfied with training certain individuals or preaching them so that they will believe in something in one way or another. No organization should focus the efforts on creating such personalities. Thankfully, Jamaatul Mustafa, the International Al-Mustafa University, can be an active center in these areas. In Qom, the centers which have thankfully been created can ensure this. We need to thank the fashion management of the Islamic seminaries. Some promotional organizations are also working well in this regard. We must build personalities who can be a manifestation of divine and Islamic teachings and rules. If such personalities are built, then the formation of the Islamic civilization will be definite. If it is done, there will be no doubts about its formation. I hope that God will reward you and make you successful so that you can carry out this task and future tasks in the best way possible. I, for one, thank you all you gentlemen who are undertaking this responsibility. Greetings be upon you and God's mercy.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Talks to revive the 2015 Iran deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, remain stalled after a year of intensive diplomacy. Senior diplomats from Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France and Germany, have held many rounds of talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The diplomatic initiative to restore the deal has become a long and complex saga. Whether negotiators will finally cross the finishing line is anyone's guess. All parties have acknowledged that there are a few remaining gaps that need to be bridged between Washington and Tehran before the deal emerges. But what's keeping the talks from further progress? It has been repeatedly said that Washington's refusal to remove Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps from its terrorism blacklist is the most important sticking point. But Iran's top diplomat has given a vastly different account of what is blocking the path of the negotiations. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum on Thursday that the issue of the IRGC being on the U.S. blacklist of terrorist groups is a minor issue that has been exaggerated and magnified by the Israeli lobby, and that Iran's top priority is the interests of the nation. He also warned that American interests and foreign policy have been taken hostage by the Israeli regime. Israel has made no secret of its opposition to the 2015 deal and diplomacy with Iran. It has been engaged in a not-so-covert campaign to derail the Vienna negotiations. U.S. President Joe Biden was a vociferous critic of Trump's unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018. During his presidential campaign, he pledged to work to rejoin the agreement. But has he done so? Iran's top diplomat says that has not been the case so far.
The fact that the United States, under the Biden administration, has failed to return to compliance with the agreement shows that the United States is not really interested in a rules-based international order, because one of the most basic pillars of international law, by the United States' own agreement, are United Nations Security Council resolutions. And again, it's binding.
Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum that Biden's policy towards Iran has not been different from Trump's hostile approach. The Iranian foreign minister said the U.S. president must decide now whether he wants to waste time or courageously return to complying with U.S. commitments under the 2015 deal. His comments come after U.S. Special Envoy for Iran Robert Malley said the prospects of a return to the Iran nuclear deal are tenuous at best. Malley made the remarks on the same day that the Biden administration unveiled new sanctions on Iran. The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran noted, however, that Washington still believes it is in the national security interests of the United States to try to salvage the 2015 agreement. The future of the hard-earned international deal remains unclear and could unravel completely if Washington fails to return to its commitments. Meanwhile, Israel is doing its utmost to prevent any deal between Washington and Iran, just as it did before the JCPOA came into existence in 2015.
No group and no block of people has more power and influence in the United States than Jewish leaders in shaping how Americans think and American attitudes. And that's not only true, but it's especially true with regard to Iran. The American media is overwhelmingly very hostile to Iran. And this is in keeping with what Jewish leaders and all those who support Israel really want.
Will the administration of Joe Biden be able to withstand pressure exerted by the Israeli lobby and act based on America's national interests?
The U.S. has been shocked by another deadly shooting incident. A gunman has shot dead 19 young children and two adults at an elementary school in the U.S. state of Texas. The carnage happened at a school in the city of Uvalde. The gunman has been identified by law enforcement as 18-year-old Salvador Ramos. The teenager is suspected of shooting his grandmother before the rampage. A U.S. Border Patrol official who was nearby when the shooting began rushed into the school and shot and killed the gunman. The shooter was wearing body armor as he carried out the attack. In a speech from the White House, U.S. President Joe Biden said he was sick and tired of responding to mass shootings as he called for gun control. This is the deadliest U.S. school shooting since the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut, in which 20 children and 6 staff were killed. The bloodshed has revived calls for gun control measures in the U.S. School shootings have become recurring emergencies in the U.S. There have already been 27 school shootings this year alone. 26 school shootings were recorded last year. The massacre at Robb Elementary School happened only 10 days since several people were killed in a racially motivated mass shooting in New York.
The U.S. has a unique gun culture with the right to possess firearms enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. The United States is the only nation in the world where civilian guns outnumber the people. There are 120 guns for every 100 Americans. No other nation has more civilian guns than people. Americans are estimated to own 393 million of the 857 million civilian guns available, which is around 46% of the world's civilian gun cache. In 2019, the number of U.S. deaths from gun violence was about 4 per 100,000 people. That's 18 times the average rate in other developed countries. Multiple studies show access to guns contributes to higher firearms-related homicide rates. The U.S. recorded the largest number of gun-related suicides in the world every year from 1990 to 2019. And no other developed nation has mass shootings at the same scale or frequency as the U.S. The issue of gun ownership and stricter control on arms has sharply divided the U.S. society. The powerful National Rifle Association is a key player here. The NRA Institute for Legislative Action is its lobbying division. Over its history, the organization has influenced legislation, participated in or initiated lawsuits, and endorsed or opposed various candidates at local, state, and federal levels. The U.S. is deeply divided over the issue of gun control, and events like the Uvalde tragedy do not change the entrenched views. However, there is no sign that Democrats will get any closer to passing tighter gun control legislation. Some Republicans are already accusing them of using this latest school shooting to further their own political objectives.
A 21-gun salute was performed in the honor of the Iranian president as Oman's Sultan Haitham bin Tariq received Ebrahim Raisi, who was on a one-day visit to the Persian Gulf country. The high-ranking delegations representing the two countries held discussions before the meeting between the two heads of state was held. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, was also among the high-ranking delegation. He met with his Omani counterpart, Saeed Badr al-Busaidi, on Monday. The Iranian president said dialogue and cooperation among regional nations would create security, noting that the presence of foreign forces not only won't serve to secure the region, but will threaten peace too.
I think first and foremost, it's important to highlight that it's significant that the first visit for the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, to the to the neighboring countries is to Oman. Oman is renowned as the Switzerland, if you like, of the region, a country that enjoys good ties with everyone, a country that tries to stay neutral, a country that tries to be the facilitator and mediator in a number of contentious issues. And Oman has strived to maintain these ties, whether it's with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with UAE, with Qatar, across the entire spectrum. And this is what leads many to believe that this visit by Iran to Oman is testament, of course, one, to this ability of Gulf states to have good ties with Iran, and two, as a model through which Gulf states can have ties with Iran and which Iran can have ties with Gulf states, a relationship that respects the integrity of one another, and in a relationship that boosts economic ties, and a relationship that tries to promote dialogue first and foremost, as opposed to trying to settle scores.
Ebrahim Raisi further welcomed what he called Tehran and Muscat's remarkably similar stance on a multitude of matters. The Iranian president hailed the visit as one that opened a new chapter in the bilateral relations between Iran and Oman. An Iranian delegation of 50 tradesmen and economic operators traveled to Oman last week in order to pave the way for the development of economic and trade ties between the two friendly countries. Iranian Minister of Road and Urban Development, Rostam Qasemi, announced that Oman and Iran are going to sign a transportation agreement in order to establish a joint shipping line and tourist flights between the two countries. The two sides signed 13 documents and memoranda of understanding in such fields as energy, politics, transportation, diplomacy, economy, tourism, sports, and the environment. Oman is also seeking to import gas from Iran by building an offshore pipeline between the two nations.
Renew Iranian access to the global economy. And part of that, or part of the Iranian considerations, is to find a reliable partner that it trusts in order to help to facilitate that re-access or rehabilitation into the international markets. And Oman, being a country that is particularly trusted by Iran, that has good ties with Iran, that has proven time and time again, or rather this relationship has proven time and time again, to be a steady relationship between Oman and Iran. Iran wants to utilize Oman's unique position in the region, not just in terms of its strategic location, but also with regards to its international free trade agreements, with which Oman enjoys even with the likes of the United States. The idea being that Oman is a good hub through which to essentially propel Iranian goods or Iranian businesses or Iranian investments, or even to receive investments from abroad via Oman, via a trusted partner.
Iran and Oman have agreed to form a committee to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, which straddles both countries' sea borders. In 2005, both countries signed a memorandum of understanding to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, but the agreement did not materialize. This is why the Iranian president said the trip marked a departure, as the documents and memorandum of understanding will be implemented this time.
The Labour victory ends nearly a decade of Conservative rule in Australia. Minister Scott Morrison conceded defeat after an election on Saturday, and the opposition Labour Party was set to end almost a decade of Conservative rule, possibly with the support of pro-environment independents. Anthony Albanese says he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish. He said he wanted to unite the country. He told his supporters, "I think people want to come together. Look for our common interest, look towards that sense of common purpose. I think people have had enough of division. What they want is to come together as a nation, and I intend to lead that." Labour has secured a parliamentary majority in general elections, but Albanese may still need a coalition partner to rule. He has indicated that they'll be picked from like-minded independents. The new Labour government promises to reset Australia's relations with the world. Albanese has also promised to create stronger ties with Asia. He said, "We live in a region whereby in the future we will have China, India, and Indonesia as giants. We need to strengthen that economic partnership, and one way that we can do that is by strengthening people-to-people relations as well." Labour has promised more financial assistance and the robust social safety net as Australia grapples with the highest inflation since 2001 and soaring housing prices. The party also plans to increase minimum wages. Others will be watching closely to see if Albanese's premiership brings a less hawkish tone on China, and whether ministerial meetings with Beijing resumes after a more than two-year hiatus. On the foreign policy front, it has proposed to establish a Pacific Defense School to train neighboring armies in response to China's potential military presence on the Solomon Islands. In late April, the Solomon Islands signed a security pact with China. The outgoing Australian leader was highly critical of China in particular and Asian countries in general. He had earlier accused his main opponent of being Beijing's preferred candidate. Relations between China and Australia have strained since 2018, when Australia became the first country to ban the Chinese telecom giant Huawei from its 5G wireless networks. Australia has long been known as the lucky country, partly due to its wealth of coal and gas, as well as minerals like iron ore, which have driven generations of economic growth. But it's now sitting on the frontier of a climate crisis, and the fires, floods, and droughts that are expected to become more extreme due to the rising global temperatures. Labour wants to tackle climate change with an ambitious 43% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. It also has pledged to reach emission net zero by 2050, partly by strengthening the mechanism used to pressure companies to make cuts. To speed up the transition to renewable energy, Labour plans to modernise Australia's energy grid and roll out solar banks and community batteries. But despite its net zero commitment, Labour says it'll approve new coal projects if they're environmentally and economically viable. The Conservative government had been called a climate holdout by the United Nations Secretary General after outlining a plan to get to net zero by 2050 by creating massive new gas projects. Incumbent Scott Morrison had said he would back a transition from coal to renewable energy, but had no plans to stop new coal projects.
Oh, the legacy is awful. We have the worst climate change policies on the planet, courtesy of this government. They were promoting new coal mines. A huge part of their argument was we had to open up more mines as fast as possible. So it was, you know, crashing headlong into climate change and denying any role in it. Foreign policy was a joke.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. In this episode of A Better Life, we are going to discuss the effects and impacts of getting closeness to Allah. And of course, in the previous episodes, we also discussed some of the effects of closeness to Allah, proximity to Allah. But in this episode, we are going to focus on one of the effects of closeness to Allah, which is peace of mind and confidence. Whenever a man gets close to Allah, the Lord of the universe, of course, all other things appear light and small to him. All other things appear and seem insignificant to him. He feels that he is under his protection. He is under the protection of Allah the Almighty. So nothing can be harmful to him because he consigns all his matters to Allah. And he rests assured that nothing is going to affect him or nothing is going to harm him. He will not suffer any difficulties and pain except that they are to his own benefit, and Allah will give him rewards for those pains and sufferings. Of course, pains and sufferings are there. Even the Holy Prophet of Islam and all the prophets suffered in their lives. They suffered at the hands of the people among whom the Holy Prophet lived. So sometimes blessing, pains and sufferings are actually a kind of blessing in disguise. We think that they are bad. أَسَىٰ أَن تَكْرَهُ شَيْئًا وَهُوَ خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ. We think that pain is something bad for us while it is good for us. You know, this is what the Quran says. And there are many people in the world who comfortable lives, but they suffer a lack of peace and confidence. There's no doubt about it. In this time around, and in this age, of course, peace of mind is something that many people lack, many people are looking for. People do not live a peaceful life because of certain problems that they encounter in their daily life. Many people, for example, resort to alcoholic drinks, many people to narcotic drugs to decrease their spiritual, you know, pain and to decrease their self-consciousness. And finally, they, you know, many people commit suicide because they do not have peace and they do not have confidence in their life. Peace of mind is an important asset which many people seem to be deprived of. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
وَمَنْ أَعْرَضَ عَنْ ذِكْرِي فَإِنَّ لَهُ مَعِيشَةً ذَنْكَ وَنَحْشُرُهُ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ أَعْمَى. God Almighty says in the Holy Quran, verse 124 of chapter 20, and whoever turns away from my reminder, وَمَنْ أَعْرَضَ عَنْ ذِكْرِي, whoever stop remembering me, shall surely be a straitened life. He will have a difficult life. وَنَحْشُرُهُ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ أَعْمَى, and he will be raised on the day of judgment, on the day of resurrection, he will be raised blind. And this is a warning given to those people who do not offer their prayers, who do not remember Allah, who do not worship Allah, who do not fulfill their, you know, duties to Allah. Allah bidhikrillahi tatma'inul qulub. You know, surely by Allah's remembrance are the hearts at rest. You know, if you are looking for peace of mind, you have to remember Allah, because remembering Allah is an act of gratitude, an act of expressing gratitude to Allah. We should be grateful to Allah, and it's because of ingratitude that we suffer. Ya ayatuha nafsul mutmainna, O soul that art at rest, irja'i ila rabbika radiyatan mardiyya, return to your Lord well pleased and well pleasing. So these verses in fact means that we are not created for this world. We have been created only to live for a few days in this world, but the permanent, you know, abode or the place where we are going to live permanently is the hereafter. And we have to be prepared for that day. Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam says that the reason why the pious are not afraid of losing anything and everything becomes easy for them is that they have appreciated his greatness. They have understood Allah's greatness, Allah's magnificence. So that's why nothing else is important in their eyes. If you are on a beach close to the ocean, you do not pay any attention to a glass of water and the hand of a baby. No? Imam Ali alayhi wasalam says about the pious men, about muttaqin, عَظُمَ الْخَالِقْ فِي أَنفُسِهِمْ فَسَغَرَ مَا دُونَهُ فِي أَعْيُنِهِمْ. And this is a very important maxim from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, which says the greatness of the Creator is seated in their hearts. عَظُمَ الْخَالِقْ فِي أَنفُسِهِمْ. And so everything else appears small and insignificant in their eyes. فَسَغَرَ مَا دُونَهُ فِي أَعْيُنِهِمْ. When you are close to Allah, when you have true faith in Allah, and when you understand that this world is transient, this world is fleeting, then that the other world is the permanent abode, then you will not give importance to this world. You will not dedicate your life to the material life. You will work hard to achieve God's satisfaction, God's, you know, proximity to Allah. And no matter what you should do, no matter how difficult it might be, so you will work to achieve divine pleasure. Of course, there's still another reason why peace and confidence come after faith and the closeness to Allah. Human beings are innately thirsty to reach the infinite good and perfection. Every individual you talk to, he will tell you that, okay, I wish I had infinite good, infinite perfection.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
No one abhors perfection. No one detests, you know, infinite good. And of course, some people unfortunately take something which is not good for them, but they consider it to be good. For example, money, fame, and power, they, in their eyes, according to some people, these are good things. And they try to obtain each of them, you know, money, fame, reputation. They think, some people naively think, that these are the things which guarantees their happiness. These are means which Islam is not opposed to money, to power. Of course, you know, power is good. But these are means only. And these are not the ultimate goals for which we are created. Only closeness to Allah can satisfy man. Let us submit our hearts with Imam Sajjad while he prays. Nothing will cool my burning thirst but reaching you. Nothing quench my thirst but meeting you. Nothing damp my yearning but gazing upon your face. Nothing will settle my settling place without closeness to you. Let us work hard to achieve perfection. And achieving perfection is possible by complying with God's order, by obeying Him, by worshipping Him, by glorifying Him. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, He knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, He knows.
Ukraine on fire. Part 1.
Here in Kiev in recent days, the Maidan, Independence Square, has turned into a full-scale war zone.
More clashes in Ukraine's capital, Kiev.
There is absolutely no doubt that snipers are working here. I've counted 10 bodies.
Now on the brink of a civil war, at least 70 dead so far, and the death toll rising.
What we saw here today was a revolution.
We've invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals.
NATO has expanded into 13 countries, up to the borders of Russia. 13 countries.
Focus has to be on not allowing this crisis to turn into hot war between Ukraine and Russia.
Ukraine. It's an ancient and proud land with a rich history filled with much beauty, heroism, and sacrifice. Ukraine is a borderland, a place where east meets west. This is the flag of Ukraine. The blue represents the sky, the gold its seemingly endless fields of wheat. Ukraine is a prize many have sought, and much blood has spilled in the quest to possess it. Ukraine has been the pathway for Western powers as they attempted to conquer the East in World War I and World War II. And every time, the Ukrainian people ended up paying the highest price for these grand games of power. History doesn't repeat, but it surely rhymes, said Mark Twain. If one looks closely at the history of Ukraine, one will notice many rhymes. Being surrounded by stronger powers, Ukraine has needed a lot of cunning to survive, and the art they truly mastered with time is the art of changing sides. In the middle of the 17th century, Ukrainian leader Bogdan Khmelnytsky broke a truce agreement made with Poland, siding with more powerful Russia. Just over 50 years later, as the Russian-Swedish War was raging, another Ukrainian leader, Ivan Mazepa, broke the union with Russia when he switched sides, joining forces with the Swedish invaders. Many times, Ukrainian history was written by third parties. Seeking to keep the gains of a revolution at any cost, Russia agreed to the humiliating conditions of the Brest-Litovsk Treaty of 1918, which turned Ukraine into a German protectorate. Another historical document that changed the fate of Ukraine was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939. One of many such agreements being signed between European countries and rising Germany. Attempting to protect his nation from the approaching Nazi threat, Joseph Stalin negotiated a treaty of non-aggression with Adolf Hitler. While promising each other peace, the Soviet and German foreign ministers Molotov and Ribbentrop realigned the map of Eastern Europe, splitting it into German and Soviet spheres of influence. No sooner had the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact been signed than Poland was split. And in September of 1939, Eastern Poland awoke to be Western Ukraine and a part of the family of Soviet republics and the USSR. But even this bold dividing of lands and nations only delayed the inevitable. Germany broke its promise to the USSR. On June 22, 1941, Germany invaded the USSR, launching Barbarossa, the largest military operation in world history. Barbarossa was aiming for St. Petersburg, Moscow, and Kiev, Ukraine, three destinations of major significance. Ukraine, with its rich lands and resources, was an important industrial and economic source for the USSR. To cut it off from the Soviet Union would strike a big blow indeed. For most of the Soviet Union, the Second World War was about fighting the invaders of their land. But it wasn't quite so simple for Ukraine. The truth is, Ukraine has never been a united country. When World War II broke out, a large part of Western Ukraine's population welcomed the German soldiers as liberators from the recently forced upon them Soviet rule and openly collaborated with the Germans. The real scale of collaboration was not announced for many years after the war, but we now know that whole divisions and battalions were formed by Ukrainian collaborators, such as SS Galician, Noctigal, and Roland battalions. Just in the beginning of the war, more than 80,000 people from Galicina region voluntarily enrolled into Division SS Galician in a month and a half, notorious for their extreme cruelty towards the Polish, Jewish, and Russian people on the territory of Ukraine. Members of these military groups came mostly from the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, the OUN, Founded in 1929, this organization had an ultimate goal of creating an ethnically pure, independent Ukraine, and considered terror an acceptable tool for achieving their ends. Their official flag was black and red, land and blood. It will remain in Ukraine's history long after the OUN will cease to exist. In early